voice comes in, you know it is time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to
DLC.
Woo! Especially if you're one of our geeks in sneaks using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Or hey, maybe you're just getting through the week. Maybe you're trying to get a little exercise, getting outdoors. Maybe you're bundled up. Maybe you got your ear pods in. Whatever the case, we're going to be with you in those ear holes for 90 plus minutes of gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be. And that is completely free thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. Those heroes, yes, I said it, heroes, make this show possible by supporting us. And in exchange, they get some cool perks, including ad-free versions of the show, video versions of the show on demand, and a whole boatload of bonus content. They've got Feeling This, two seasons of Feeling This with Christian Spicer and Alex Solman talking about the feelings behind video games. They've got the DLC Book Club audio version exclusive to patrons. They've got spoiler chats and extra content, plus the paid DLC program, which this week was pretty special. It was our first foray into live play. Yes, folks, we discovered live play here 10 years in. And it was a lot of fun. We did Helldivers 2, Lana Bashinsky, Christian Spicer, myself, playing a little Helldivers 2, exclusive for the paid DLC folks. We're going to see if people want more of that content going forward. You can get in on all that action by heading over to patreon.com/DLCpod. But this show, the main show, DLC, it's the show all about games. And there are many forms, games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata, the spell with two N's and one T. And I am joined, as always, by my friend, slash co-host, slash nemesis. The guy who loves explaining jokes, Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Jeff. Hello, everyone. I think it turns out our audience does want more Let's Plays from us. They just don't want it to replace paid DLC. So I think soon enough, Jeff, you'll get to say even more bevy of content that patrons will be getting. Because if my gut were to tell me, my gut would tell me that's the way it's going to go, is that this is going to be an addition, not a replacement or a subtraction.
I think we might. The demand seems to be there. Folks are really enjoyed it, and we had a great time too. So we might be adding more bonus content to the paid DLC. We're pushing forward. We're trying to get those numbers up, get more support, make sure the show continues. So if you would like to see us play games, I think there's going to be an announcement very soon about how you can.
Yeah, this wasn't it.
No.
Yeah, no.
No. This is the tune in. Stay tuned for an announcement forthwith. This is the trailer for the trailer.
Yeah.
We have an amazing show for you this week, ladies and gentlemen. It's there's tons to talk about. We are checking up on the Xbox business, I'm sure, at some point. We'll be podcasting about a podcast eventually. And we got lots of games to get to, some really fun stuff to chat about. And we have an awesome guest to do it with. You know, the DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian. But this week, I'm excited because DLC stands for Dramatizing the Legacy of a Crime, because we have not only the co-host of the Gamers with Jobs conference call, but he also happens to be debuting his new one-man show, Lovejoy on Lovejoy, about his own ancestor's murder in 1837. It's our friend Rich Lovejoy back with us. Hey, Rich, how are you?
I am. My brain is kind of melting a little bit with everything that I've been doing to prepare for this project. So I very much appreciate that excited, high energy introduction for this play that is about the murder of my abolitionist ancestor by a pro-slavery mob in 1837. I'm excited that we can also be one of the few video game shows to be advertising a live theatrical event at the top of the show.
Well, I think our audience here is sick of me bringing on people who are doing plays about their abolitionist ancestors being murdered in 1837. But we have yet another one, folks.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
It's just a trope at this point.
all last year, it was like, is Microsoft going to acquire Activision? Are we going to promote another play about an abolitionist being murdered by slave loving people in 1837? And it's like every week, same story. But it's 2024 now, so we get to do it again.
Honestly, Rich, I'm so curious about this. It seems like such a cool project. Tell us a little bit about Lovejoy on Lovejoy.
Yeah, so this has been a family story that, like many family stories, you have it kind of percolating in the background, but you don't really look into it, and you just sort of accept that it's there. And then of course, Elijah Lovejoy was a newspaper editor, so there's a lot of primary sources, and it was time to do a big deep dive on it, and I was blown away by how relevant all of this is for today, unfortunately. A lot of the same dynamics and issues that were going on in the early 1800s have been repeated and are still happening today. And this play is, you know, this is a work in progress. This is my first iteration of it. It's a 40-minute show. It's part of the Chain Theater's one-act festival. And one of the cool things they're doing, because we live in a world of a pandemic, is they're doing a streaming show. So on the 25th, which is a Sunday, at around 5 or 5:30, I forget which, because my brain is, like I said, melting, Eastern time, there's going to be a live stream, so you'll be able to watch this play and two other one-act plays that'll go before it that are shorter pieces. One, I think those both are 15 minutes. Mine's a 40-minute play. And you can go to chaintheater.org. And if you enter the code LOVE, because my last name is Lovejoy, and the show is Lovejoy on Lovejoy, and there's going to be a talk back after the show, which I'm going to dub Lovejoy on Lovejoy on Lovejoy. so you can, it's going to be the greatest thing since my, we need to talk about Kevin podcast. We need to talk about Kevin. you should all, I think people should check this out. It's a really, I know seeing theater over a screen isn't the ideal platform, but I think it's a really important story. I think it's a really interesting story, and I think it'll leave, people with a lot to think about afterwards.
I want to ask you a few questions about the talk back specifically, but mostly just so we can say it's Lovejoy on Lovejoy on Lovejoy on Lovejoy.
Oh man, we could inception this. Let's make it happen.
That is really, really cool. Did through the process of writing the play and you know, figuring out how you wanted to tell this tale, did you learn things that you didn't already know about your own family?
Yeah, absolutely. There's just so much stuff there. And there's, I think, a lot of things that people take for granted when we look at history. Like one of the big things that, spoiler alert for a play that hopefully some people will see. But one of the big things, like when we think about the 1800s, I think a lot of people have this idea that, you know, slavery was this binary issue, right? Like there were people in the North who were against it and the people in the South were for it. But the reality was it was super complicated, and there were a lot of different camps that wanted different things and had different ideas and different approaches, and they mirror some of the camps that we have in our reality today. So like it was neat to see some of that stuff and to kind of unpack both the flaws that Elijah Lovejoy had as a person, but also the sort of the aspirational willingness to embrace a more radical action that was out of step with what was popular and normal at the time. And thinking about that and how we as a country right now, who's still in the throes of some of these same ideological battles, can break out of that kind of cycle, this kind of endless cycle that we're in. Like, how do we actually evolve out of it? And then you put it through the lens of family. You know, we have that in families too, right? Like there's a lot of talk about people who are trauma or are cycle breakers, who come from like traumatic repeated patterns in families and break out of it. So what I'm trying to do, the very simple task, is to just, what can I do to make America just break out of its cycle, its trauma cycle? That's all. You know, pretty easy simple, objective.
Yeah.
For
low-hanging fruit there. Yeah.
Yeah, I can do it in 40 minutes on a stage.
Boom.
No problem.
That's awesome. And, you know, certainly as video gamers, we love, you know, we love learning about history. We love delving into these stories that, you know, personas and questions that are very different from our lives. I think that's part of what makes gamers gamers, is kind of stepping into another place, another time. And that's kind of, you know, what you're doing here. I wonder if your interest in the hobby was reflected in this project, or if it kind of ran parallel to it in some way.
It's very funny that you mentioned that. One of the first big breakout theatrical indie theater hit that I had was a play called Adventure Quest, which was, in fact, a play in the style of a Sierra Online adventure game, with a character walking around on stage and walking up to people and going, "Talk to man." And then the person would have a set speech, and he would just pick up every object and try to randomly combine things.
That's funny.
It was a super fun show. But the hobby is slightly reflected in this piece, actually. This is Lovejoy on Lovejoy has the distinction of being the only play about an abolitionist to feature the solo performer wearing a Pentiment t-shirt.
Whoa, there you go. Yeah.
Which is, you know, I'm playing the character of Richard Lovejoy, so I had to get into Richard Lovejoy's head a little bit and kind of do the things that Richard Lovejoy would do and wear the clothes that he would wear. And Richard Lovejoy has this Pentiment t-shirt, and he let me borrow it for the show as a costume. So
that's, you know, very kind of him for, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he's got to be kind to himself sometimes. That's part of the breaking out of the trauma cycles, right? Be kind to yourself.
Awesome. Well, we will repeat at the end how folks can tune in on this. But again, it's February 25th that you'll be performing live. You can watch the live stream. Very cool way to be able to watch this wherever you happen. It's going to be in New York City, right? But you will.
It is going to be in New York City at the Chain Theater. If you're in New York City and you want to go to the Chain Theater one act and go to Program 12, that the show actually opens on Tuesday, the 20th. Just say Jeff sent me, and I'll give you the discount code of like maybe a beer.
There you go.
Yeah,
that sounds like a pretty sweet deal.
Yeah. A beer in New York City, that's like a $50 promo code, folks. So you gotta,
it'll be
that
a tax
write
off because I'm doing it for a play. So it's fine.
All right. So you heard it here, DLC listeners. Put Rich in the poorhouse by how many people show up at the play and ask for a beer. It'll be awesome. All right. Well, let's get into it. We got a lot to talk about. So let's start the show the way we always do, with Story of the Week.
Story of the week, it's the story of the week. Story of the week, it's the story of the week.
Story of the week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. You can also send comments, questions, anything you would like us to know. We love hearing from you over there at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. Incidentally, before we even get into it, I do need to address the elephant in the room, re-emails this week, because I was taken to task about some unflattering things I had to say about Club Penguin last week. And I take it all back. I have been schooled. Some folks told me that Club Penguin is still alive and well. I insinuated that Disney's Club Penguin was a massive failure, and that if it had been more successful, it'd still be going. But guess what? It is still be going. It is still going. And there are people in Club Penguin as we speak. So apologies. Thank you all for your emails correcting me on Club Penguin. Anywho, DLC feedback.
Don't worry about that, Jeff. I, on Gamers with Jobs, one time said Fortnite doesn't exist anymore and nobody plays it and nobody likes it. And then I was very quickly corrected on that. It turns out, did you hear that this thing's actually huge?
I'm not familiar with what are you, Fortnite.
Yeah, that's
not,
the thing. It sounds like a niche way to refer to 2 weeks.
It does.
To be fair, Again, that's dlcfeedback@gmail.com. Club Penguin was shut down in 2017. It was brought back as some other thing. But the Club Penguin memory that you had of it being shut down, accurate. It being huge, also accurate.
Direct your emails to together. Christian this time. yes. Anyway, story of the week. You can also hang out in our Discord where you can, you know, correct us in front of other people as well. That is 5x5 DLC on Discord. Great folks hanging out, talking about games. Check it out. Okay, Rich, you are our guest. You get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
I mean, so one of the things about the stories of the stories of the week is that a lot of them seem to be somewhat related or like adjacent to each other in some way. So I'm tempted to talk about Xbox business, but let's have a little PlayStation amuse-bouche first and talk a little bit about that, because that's a story that this story has come out that the PS5 is nearing the end of its life cycle. And this is a story that my suspicion is that this is slightly overblown. I feel like what is actually being said in this story is that the PlayStation 5, which is 4 years old, is in the, you know, missing its sale targets. Sony's going through one, as every company is right now, that is trying to chase an arbitrary number that is bigger than a previous number, instead of just saying maybe number be okay to not be larger sometimes, or only be slightly larger instead of insanely larger. But the four-year-old PlayStation 5 is probably in the latter half of its life cycle, is I think what the intention of the comment was. So we're still talking 3 or 4 more years. Like, there's still going to be a PlayStation 5. We're not talking about PlayStation 6 showing up in Christmas or anything, like, you know, right. Like this, right. It's just not, this is not I don't think this is somebody like PlayStation, the PlayStation 5 is on the plank and about to walk into the shark infested waters below. I think I don't know why I'm just adding metaphors to this, but it's been good.
It's easy to read this, which, let's be fair, I think was reported in translation. So let's note that as well. I think this was originally something that was said by Sony's senior vice president in Japanese, and I think it was translated. The idea of it being nearing the end of its life cycle, certainly I could certainly sympathize with the person going, oh, PlayStation 6 debuting at not E3 this year. We're hearing about it. It's 2026. Here it comes. 25, whatever. I don't know what year we're in. Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think that's the case. It does seem like a wildly inappropriate thing to just say out loud, you know, if you're the senior vice president of a giant multi-billion-dollar corporation. This feels like a poorly thought through quote. But as you say, it really speaks to the sort of state of the industry as a whole, and not I think specifically where the PlayStation 5 is. But yes, it is. Sales are slowing. It's funny, you know. They're like, people aren't buying these as like we thought they would, and we're giving them no reasons this year to do so. So, that's the funniest part. Is like, we have zero first party titles coming out in 2024, and people. So I don't understand why people aren't rushing out. They got to have these. I don't know. But you know, I think the PlayStation 5 has sold over 50 million units, something like that. We're at there's a huge install base. I don't think we're going to get a PlayStation 6 anytime soon. We just got the slim PlayStation 5. We have had a very odd life cycle beginning, first half of a life cycle for this generation of consoles, because we had, you know, the weirdness with COVID and supply chain and all the stuff that sort of happened right around the release of these the first couple of years of these consoles' lifetimes. And, you know, it's a strange thing to be talking about maybe phasing them out already, or thinking to the next generation, when it seems to me, and I think a lot of people, that we haven't even really hit the stride. It's been most of the stuff that we've seen is, you know, cross-generational releases or, you know, remasters, something that's brought it onto the new generation. We haven't really seen the, oh my God, look what's possible now type stuff that was promised. And I do think that's still to come. I don't think that we are going to miss out on the PlayStation 5 having its moment. But I do think this was a wildly inappropriate thing to get into the headlines and have people like us talk about.
Yeah.
Christian, what? Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No, please, Rich,
I just have a, I just wonder too, I was thinking about the possibility of it being a translation misfire too. Maybe it isn't even an inappropriate thing to say. It could have been doing something like if somebody saw me on the street and said, that guy's middle-aged. If somebody said that of the PlayStation 5's life cycle, that's probably fair.
You know? Right. Right. I mean, evidently the exact quote is, looking ahead, PS5 will enter the later stage of its life cycle.
I mean, that's true of everything. If you look ahead at some point, a thing will enter the latter stages of its life cycle.
This fruit fly in 14 seconds will enter the late stage of its life cycle. I just think this is I don't think this is a nothing burger. I think it is a bit of a mountain out of a molehill, but I do think there is a molehill there, which is, this is a weird generation. This is a weird console generation, one that is kind of not going as planned, but we knew that already. Christian, I wonder what your reaction to this headline was. Or you, we read more than the headline.
No. I just wait for you to read them to me, to be perfectly honest, and then I react, my gut. I think that part of this also, this was an investor call, right? This wasn't a Sony state of play. This wasn't a press release. This is the type of statement, again, assuming accurate translation and reporting, which I'm going to assume. This is the type of statement that can be made this year, and then I'm making stuff up. But then say in 2025, new Sony Santa Monica comes out, new Naughty Dog comes out, new Sony Bend comes out, new Insomniac comes out, and they make a statement saying, this is a banner year for PlayStation. The PlayStation 5 is going to be strong for years to come. Because this statement right now is a statement justifying their current incomes and revenue expectations alongside costs that they're delivering to shareholders. Whereas that hypothetical next year statement would be them justifying those revenues and projections and costs to shareholders. A lot of these statements, if you look back across industry, people justify what's happening in the moment in a way to make it make sense and also paint the idea of their business in the best light possible within the confines in the United States of what the SEC allows someone to say. And I don't know Japanese specific financial reporting laws or requirements. I would assume they have some. And so, you know, yeah, we're at a downturn right now, or we're not hitting these numbers that we projected we'd hit. Here's a reason why that is reasonable and you understand, and also doesn't make you panic about our core business strategy in this market. Easy. And as Rich pointed out, this is just a statement. After I was born, I was going to at some point enter the end of my life cycle. Like, that's how it works. So this feels to me like a very safe statement about explaining the odd predicament, Jeff, as you mentioned, we are in this console generation, whereas it was brought about during a pandemic. And because of that, there were supply chain difficulties, but also a fever pitch appetite for software and these games. And we coming off a year like last year with all these incredible games that finally came out as those floodgates broke open. And now leading into this year, without that many of big marquee titles from these marquee studios, we're in this weird spot of, what is this generation? What is it going to be? How is this revenue trend going to continue? How do we explain it? And I think Microsoft is about to do the same thing in our next story, Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong. We will continue to talk more about it. But I do think the reason this felt so discordant to folks hearing this quote is I don't think this is a – it's wrong to hear that and go, what? What? Because – there really hasn't been that thing we've seen almost every other generation. I say almost, I don't even think almost belongs, every other generation, where there are these huge titles that could only be possible on that new piece of hardware, right? And I don't think we've seen that. We certainly doesn't feel like we've seen that. Even the stuff that is exclusive to PS5, it doesn't feel like a huge leap from those late stage PS4 bangers, you know? Even like a Last of Us Part 2 remastered, yeah, it looks better than the PS4 version, but it's not, oh my God, that justifies the hardware better. We haven't seen things that feel like, oh wow, this new console generation is a leap forward, even though it was purported to be one of the biggest leaps forward, the PlayStation 5. So, we've seen faster load times. We've seen a lot of stuff available on all the previous generation of console. We've seen a lot of, incremental upgrades. There just hasn't been that thing that's left its mark as to what defines this generation. And then to hear, well, we've sort of peaked. We crested the peak and we're down on the other side. We're heading toward, the end here. It just feels like, well, when did the PS5 become essential? And I don't think it has had that essential moment yet, which is, I think, frustrating. It can be frustrating.
Yeah, I think development time and costs are part of that too. I think this is the generation of, oh gosh, it takes how long and how many hundreds of millions of dollars to make a game? Yoink. Or zoink, I guess is better. I think folks are feeling either. That.
I can join. I can join Grizoink in this situation. I do think that project management, time estimation skills in the video game industry, it's so hard to determine when something can actually be complete and how much it's going to cost. And I just think there's no real way for them to plan around that. And the other thing that's, I think, interesting about all of this is how it relates to the idea of this big tentpole game where studios have to basically bet the farm on every game that comes out. And if you get a hit, congratulations, you can tread water for another 6 years to make another massive thing. But if you get a miss, then it's, suddenly the Embracer Group is there stabbing you in a dark alley at night.
Or you just lay off hundreds of people.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's that, it's, and that's, I don't know that that's good or sustainable or, like this is, I sometimes think my biggest, I have a lot of worries and anxieties about where all of this could possibly head and how unsustainable all of this is, and not just in video games, but even like broader out in terms of how our economies are functioning. But my little hope to give a little bit of ray of light to like what this could look like in a way that's positive is like, okay, so what happens if we don't really have much in the way of first party games anymore, and we don't really have as many giant, massive behemoth games. Maybe there's one or two, but not, scores of them. And instead, there's just a lot of interesting niche stuff that you just sort of have to stumble across. Like, do you remember, you guys we were all roughly the same age. So you went to record stores and found cool stuff. Like, I wonder if video games will approach that type of thing again, where it's going to be a lot of interesting smaller teams making work that they're deeply passionate about. And you stumbling across it at the middle of the night on Steam or on or on itch.io or
I think we're already there, right? I think we just had Steam Next Fest last week, and it was 1,000 games, and none of them are what we're talking about as far as Sony first party or giant AAA. It was all of that kind of cool, interesting small teams, there's this really vibrant tapestry of indie games that are, I don't know how, if they're thriving, 1,000 games in Steam Next Fest seems like an untenable situation. It seems like a, you know, I don't know how anyone makes any money at that level.
As somebody who does independent theater in New York, trust me, it's fine.
Right. Well, I mean, I think even to take your former analogy, even when we were all going to, you know, Tower Records and thumbing through the, you know, the bootlegs or whatever, thumbing through the deep cuts, there was still, you know, five or six artists at the tippity top that were raking in all the cash, and everybody else was like just making a living, you know, kind of doing their thing. And I think that's kind of where we are with the video game industry. And I think it's much, I mean, again, there's problems. I'm not going to say there aren't. We've outlined them week after week here. But I think, and again, this may be damning with faint praise, but I think it's in a stronger, healthier position than the film industry. You know, I think, again, maybe low bar, but the film industry, I think, is in a much scarier place because there isn't a vibrant underbelly of interesting indie things. There is streaming and there's great television, but there's like the movies that are made are of a very specific kind and cost a lot of money. And there's big hits and huge, lots of big failures. And then there's nothing. And then there's like some real low budge stuff that goes to film festivals and people are scraping by, but there's no like healthy middle. And I do think there is much more of one in the video game industry than in the film industry.
I'm glad that my interests are largely film, theater, and video games. I've really, really chosen some easy fields
here. Yes. Yeah, there's nothing, and there's nothing coming along technologically that will eliminate any of those. Don't worry.
I mean, I think music was the same way, Jeff. You mentioned top 40 and that all kind of always existing, but I don't know if this is a silver lining or a glass half empty to split metaphors, because it's harrowing to realize as an adult, you look back at some of your favorite, most formative bands and then learn that what are they doing now? And then you look it up and it's like, oh, struggling. They broke up in 2000 and are like happy, but they're not, you know, the Rolling Stones, right? They're not retired off of their two pop punk albums you loved in 98 and 2002. They are now working jobs that they love and with the family they love, but they're not living off of that
Operation
sweet.
Operation Ivy are all millionaires, right?
I mean, probably they are, because Rancid came later. Yeah, sure. But yes, your point is yes, in that they're working regular, and it's like the silver lining is like, wow, you don't have to be top 40 to touch somebody's life and mean something to someone.
Right.
At the same time, the glass half empty is, yeah, it's top 40 for a reason, and there's way more than 40. Way more than 40.
I like touching lives, but I also like my life to be touched by financial security. You know what I mean?
No, we are, Jeff, this show, my friend, is a pop punk album that came out in 2002. It came out at the right time, at the height of pop punk. We sold a lot of albums, but we're not top 40. We're not, no. Let's not pretend that we're
people
being,
remember, you know what I mean? Us. Remember us for our early hits. What have we done lately? Not much, let's be honest.
We opened the small stage of When We Were Young. You know, that's the festival. We're on the side stage at 2 a.m.
Well,
everyone's asking you to play Tabletop Time, right?
Yeah,
that's funny. I stand on stage and zone out just like I did before. Crowd goes wild.
Well, speaking of financial responsibilities, let's take a break for a sponsor. All right. I suspect I know what Christian's story of the week is, because Sony fans were not the only ones kvetching this week about the changing tides, and maybe their console of choice is betraying them on some level. Christian, what is your story of the week?
Yeah, my story of the week was hinted at for weeks. There was an internet kerfuffle. It became this week's story of the week because they had to move it forward because the cart got in front of the horse, and rumors are running rampant of Microsoft going full Sega, or what it was going to mean. So Xbox hosted their update on the Xbox business. They did it as a podcast, a video podcast on the Xbox Podcast YouTube page and where they post their podcasts. The main reason it's my story of the week, though, gentlemen, we start doing video podcasts. You know, we're here every week announcing business updates about DLC, what shows we have on the Patreon, what bonuses we're doing, and look who copies us. Yeah. Come on, Xbox. Can't you do a state of play? Like, no. Yeah.
Christian's always talking about the booty. They have Matt booty. It just feels.
It's the same. It's the same. Jeff had an eye patch like a Bond villain. They have a Bond. It's the same. They had their update.
We have Spicer. They have Spencer. It's the same.
Xbox and Microsoft is the most valuable corporation in the world. We have Rich. It's the same.
They did 20 minutes. 20 minutes of a podcast they did.
Hold on. Wait, Jeff. We're doing 20 minutes of riffing on their podcast. Yeah, hold on. We got to do longer.
We can make this work. My favorite thing was evidently there was a comment on the video that was like the most upvoted comment of the hundreds of thousands of comments that got on the video. And it was, this podcast could have been an email, which chef's kiss to the author of that comment, because
yeah, that's tremendous.
That's top tier. The second
most upvoted, play tabletop time. It was odd, but there it was. People really wanted to hear it. The TLDR of this 20-minute podcast is, yes, four games are going multi-platform. They did not say which four games. Sea of Thieves, Pentiment, Hi-Fi Rush, and what was the fourth one?
They did not say this. Christian,
they did not say this. I'm just saying what they are.
They said two that aren't. They said not Starfield and not Indiana Jones.
But also maybe.
But also, like,
was that possibly a mistranslation, though? They may not speak podcast. They don't.
That's true. Yeah. I did not hear one promo code given out on this podcast, so I don't know if it's real or not. I don't know. Phil sent me? What's my coupon code?
If you guys come to Lovejoy on Lovejoy and you say, Phil sent me, I'll get you an Xbox. No. that would bankrupt.
Yeah, so they did say four games are going multi-platform. They did not say which four those are. They said that Starfield and Indiana Jones are not going to PlayStation 5, but also don't rule out anything. And then Sarah Bond recommitted to hardware, saying that they're working on some exciting stuff they'll talk about later. And they said something that Jeff said just a few minutes ago in this podcast, what this generation was supposed to be, but this next generation is going to be the biggest generational leap that we've ever seen. They're committed to it. And Phil Spencer said multiple times that Xbox is everywhere. And he said all the different taglines they've had, meaning it's everywhere. Play everywhere. Xbox is for everyone. When we all gain or whatever it is. Like a bunch of these reinforcing the idea that they want it everywhere. And then it wrapped. That was kind of it.
Well, one of the things I think that was most interesting to me was that they said specifically Game Pass will not be on any other consoles. Which I thought was actually pretty surprising, because I figured that was very much in their plan. Get Game Pass, get that subscription from anybody and everybody. But they said no.
It goes against their slogan, too, of Xbox is everywhere except on the other consoles.
Right. Evidently the four titles that are going to other places, they had in their plan. Also, Spencer was like, if you take Activision Blizzard, we're one of the biggest publishers on PlayStation right now. It's like, yeah, you bought one of the biggest publishers on PlayStation. But I just thought this whole thing was really weird. You know, it's such a weird tone to strike of, let's talk to you as if you are investors in our company. And I just don't understand the gamer as invested in the company mindset thing that has somehow become the norm. Like, there are enough gamers that feel like they are not just buying a console, they're buying like stock in the company. You know, they feel like choosing which console to put in their home means they have like a vested interest in the machinations of that company on a strategic level. It makes no sense to me. It's such a weird, like, Spencer is there literally saying the quiet part loud, which is, he said with a complete straight face into the camera, he's like, you know, we need growth. And there's only two ways to get growth: squeeze more money out of our existing player base, or find new players to squeeze money out of. And he's like, and we've already always preferred the latter. And it's like, everybody's like, oh yes, please don't squeeze money out of us. Find new people to squeeze money out of. And it's like, are we all insane? Like,
which, to be fair, you can go to patreon.com/DLCpod if you're not a member and become.
By the way, if we don't have growth, we will have to be like Sega and just farm ourselves out to other podcasts.
This podcast will go third party. Yeah.
I know it's probably a little bit early for a parting gift, but, you know, Karl Marx has some interesting ideas that people might want to read about right now.
it's such a weird tone to strike, because it felt like, hey, we need to reassure our investors that they have invested correctly in our company. And it's like, well, I understand that you don't want Xbox to go away, but don't worry. The four games that are going to other you have those on your – it's such a weird thing. The most valuable company, the most valuable company in the history of humankind is going to reassure you that they're not going away. They're not – it's like I don't get any of the hullabaloo around this story. I don't get it at all. I thought there was some interesting stuff mentioned. So I'm not saying it's not worth talking about, but just the whole like pretense of the conversation, which is, you better assure me as someone who has purchased a console that you're going to continue making new versions of this console in the future. It's like, what? I don't get it.
I kind of disagree, but Rich, you've been waiting patiently. So I just wanted to stick my pin on my kind of disagree, and we can get back to it. Rich, what are your thoughts?
I think like an interesting side part of this that you brought up, Jeff, was that the treating of people who are the customers, right, as being somehow investors, and the way that plays into some of the toxicity actually within gaming, in console wars, in people doing review bombing of like Sony games or Xbox games, if they're invested in having the other one come out on
like
top. And there's
activists, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm an activist for my console. It's such an odd thing.
But it's like, I need to turn everything into a sport or a competition instead of just letting different iterations of creative work be a thing and be happy when more people can go and see that work or experience that work. And it's something that I think we are being culturally even outside of video games wired toward, like that conflict with other people, you know, and trying to identify yourself within position relative to what other people, like if I have this console, I am an Xboxer and I have green blood and I, you know,
yeah,
and anything PlayStation or Nintendo, I'm going to shout at it and say that it's for babies. It's such a weird mindset. And I wonder, it's not something I know how to unpack or what a path forward is, because it seems really disastrous and not just in terms of what it means within conflicting games, but just the broader ideas of it that it hints at about the way that our society is set up. That's my little comment, but I do want to hear what Christian, where you disagree with the Jeff's statement from earlier.
Well, Rich, I think you might be a nice thread through the needle, because I agree with a lot of what you're saying. And I think Jeff also was getting to that. I don't think we're like on different sides. That's what I'm about to say is, I think a lot of things are framed as winners and losers, even if it's, you know, pick a political debate. I don't even need to be presidential. Pick your local district attorney presidential debate. If you read to your local newspaper, it'll be who won the debate. It won't be Gary said this and Susan said this. It was who won. who
it's
won.
All horse race. Yeah.
There's a competition. Are you on the winning team?
We need to spin this instead of report.
Are you on the losing team? And I think a part of that also is, as people, and myself included, we don't want to pick wrong. There's a reason why review sites are huge and review videos are huge. And still, you know, people like seeing review scores on video games. And before I buy a TV, I research 1,000 different TVs and look at Amazon reviews, even though I know half of them are fake, or Yelp reviews before you go to a restaurant. You don't want to pick the wrong one. And video game consoles and video games are expensive. And I don't think people want to put down their hard-earned money on something and feel like they picked the wrong one because they're not going to get those games or experiences that were maybe promised to them. It's like, oh, well, I bought into this because of the things you've told me before, corporate cheerleader. And now if it's going away, I feel that's one last point. If that's going away, I feel bad. And I think these companies often try to create these fever pitched fan bases and then try to put their hands up and say, it wasn't us. Everybody should be nice to each other when things don't work out that well. But they build this like, show us your tattoos, you know, be hardcore. This person got here at 2 a.m. We're going to film them and put them on our vlog. You got to sign up early, get reward points for all this stuff. And then the A's move to Las Vegas. And that sucks, you know? It sucks. So I get it, but I think we're kind of pitted against each other in soapbox.
That reminds me of the time that I put all this like blood and chum in the water and all these sharks showed up and they were really bitey and angry. And I was like, why are you guys being like that?
We need a bigger boat.
Yeah. I'm sensitive to what you brought up in the first half of your argument as far as it is an investment. It is not an insubstantial amount of money to get into the one or the other side of these consoles. Like these, you know, it's not a small thing. And most people are not like me. They do not have an interest or a reason to have all the consoles, right? They're not going to be – I totally understand that. I'm sensitive to it. I respect it. That said, I think you mischaracterize – my problem is you sort of mischaracterize the latter half, which is like, well, I was promised these experiences. Well, you're still getting them. Like the thing that I don't get here is that I was promised that I was getting the experiences and those people weren't.
Well, because I was promised
those people weren't getting it.
Because if you knew the other people were going to get them, you would have bought the one. It's like, do you want to go to the restaurant that has just vegan food or the one that's just a butcher, or do you want both? That's why it's not that they're getting it. It's that you're not getting God of War, you know, like that's
the issue. Always not getting God of War. You made that. You're saying there was no all you could eat buffet.
There was no PC. Right.
Like, well, there is. There has always been that. But yes, I see the in the sense of like, well, I would have just gotten a PlayStation 5 if I knew I could play Starfield on it.
Yeah.
But you chose to play. You're still getting to play the thing that was most important to you. Like, it's such a weird backwards, like inverted offense, you know, like, well, I got the thing I wanted, but I could have gotten more than I wanted if had I known. It's just a weird.
Well, maybe it's like, I always feel bad, like, Rich, if someone were to buy an iPhone, like they don't know that every September new iPhones come out. And I always feel a little bad for the person who goes to the Apple store and buys the new iPhone
in August,
like August 20th.
Yeah. Yeah.
That stinks. And they're still getting what they paid for. They still looked at, $1,000 for an iPhone 15 Pro. That is a trade I'm willing to make. This seems worth it to me. And then you go home and you open your new iPhone, you go to theverge.com and you read, new iPhone coming next week. This sucks. I think it's akin to that. I think those are cousins. Those experiences.
They're cousins, but they're not the same thing. Like, and I don't know.
I also think in the case of the iPhone example, just to continue to thread needles, because now I'm gonna lean into some sewing metaphors. In the case of the iPhone, like that is it is a device that we do a lot of things on, and it is obviously part of our life. But I think when we're talking about video games, it's a little closer to, like, that's a cultural force, right? Like, that's a subscription to Hulu or Netflix. It's sort of like more of that choice. It's like, what flavor of content are you getting? Only it's like some of the shows are going to be on both Hulu and Netflix. Wow, I meant for this to be a sewing metaphor, and then it became a TV metaphor. I was like, we're like literally 10 minutes away from when I did like the shark metaphor. It's just, I don't know what's going on, guys. And I apologize for all the metaphors. It's just, I don't know. It's just happening today.
It's working for me. I'm enjoying it. Yeah, and maybe I'm being too harsh. I just feel like this is such a weird thing to have taken over, you know, the gaming sphere this week, you know, and watching them all sit there and be like, don't worry, there's still games coming to your game consoles. Like, yeah, we know. Yes. And don't worry, we're not giving all the games to the other people. It's like, I don't know. If you really want games on your console, maybe you should want the company to do the thing that lets them not lay off all the people that are making the games. You know, like, maybe we should try to get the games sold to as many places as possible so that all the people that make the games don't lose their jobs. How about that?
And also Diablo 4 is coming to Game Pass.
Oh yeah, that was, you know.
It could have been such a big announcement.
Could have been.
Yeah.
Just okay. Right under there. By the way, it's happening.
I do think it should have been an email. I also think that it was weird that it was a podcast that was rehearsed but not scripted versus Sarah or Phil or somebody just saying, you know, Phil at his desk, which he's done. I don't know. It worked for them, I guess. But
I think we need to underscore what you just said, Christian, because I'm glad you brought that up, because as somebody that has been hired to be the host of stuff like this in the past, I want everyone who listens to this podcast to be very aware that was the half dozenth time they did that today, right? They knew exactly what questions were coming. Every interruption or, oh, that's a great point, Sarah. They had done 14 times. They knew every beat of that. None of it was off the cuff. None of it was, it was a performance, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I felt like it was such a weird format to do that in for this kind of discussion. Now, having said that, it was very clear they had been planning to do this thing in this way for other reasons before this became a big brouhaha that they had to address. So I understand sort of pivoting and like, well, we've got this podcast we're going to do. Let's just use that. So I kind of understand, but you know, be clear. Like, that was not a podcast in the way this is a podcast, which is we're all talking out of our butts. Right. They all had sat down and done that. They all approved all of those. There were 14 people in a room before that who the first time they answered it went, yeah, we don't like the wording. Change your wording of that. Like, everything was approved 1,000 times and worked. And they knew exactly the way that was all going to happen. And that's okay. That doesn't mean it's inauthentic. It just means that it was a very crafted message that could have been crafted in a number of ways. They just crafted it to look like it was off the cuff and casual, which it very much was not.
If I was directing this conversation as a movie, just to jump genres again, I would immediately cut to a camera behind Jeff with the monologue that he just did on the screen.
Yeah. The bad news about that is that it means that this show has terrible writers. Writers are basically incoherent.
But just to pull the curtain back further, to be clear, when every guest on a late night talk show, all of those questions have never been vetted by that talent's handler or PR. The stories they tell are totally off the cuff. When they go, oh, you asked about the first car I bought? as I'm here to promote my new movie, Ferrari. I never thought this would come up. Let me look down the barrel of the camera and tell you about a story when I was 17 in Italy. Totally random and off the cuff.
It's weird how that question leads right into the first three jokes of my stand-up routine. I heard you just had a breakup. Oh, yeah. Let me tell you.
It's almost like, you know, they were trying to create a fight between avatars. Anyway, I don't want to talk about anything specific here.
All right. All right. I think you're trying to predict what my story of the week is going to be. You're telling me to move on. Is the prompt
it's
just
only
saying
a prediction if it wasn't scripted? Now folks are going to find out that our Bold and Cool Ranch episode is totally scripted. All those predictions are.
What was the memed thing from the Game Awards this year that please wrap it up? I can't remember the exact.
Yeah, this story. As we do story of the week, it's just like. Music starts playing.
All right. As Christian mentioned, my story of the week, I like Avatar The Last Airbender. I like all the Avatars. I'm a big fan of the Avatar. I'm a fan of The Way of the Water, and I'm a fan of Avatar The Last Airbender.
I'm a fan of Ultima, animated too. Series. Also features an Avatar.
That's right.
Avatar. Know that Britannia has entered into a new age of enlightenment.
Yes, I'm a fan of all the Avatars. I love Avatar The Last Airbender. I'm very nervous about the live action, which I think is debuting like this week, right? This Thursday, I think it debuts. The
I've
new
got
live
bad
action
news, Jeff.
Netflix
we're
series.
In it.
What's that?
This is it. This is it. This is the live action of it.
Oh.
That's the script that we've been reading and filming.
I'm a
word
bender.
We're in the podcast scene in the Avatar The Last Airbender.
Yeah.
They podcast in Avatar The Last Airbender, right? I only know the Ultima one. And Ultima has the famous Lord British podcast.
Right. Yes. Anyway, we heard this week that Avatar The Last Airbender will have a fighting game. They're entering the fighting game. And we don't know exactly who is going to be making this forthcoming title, but we do know that the publisher will be Maximum Entertainment. They're working in collaboration with Paramount to bring Avatar The Last Airbender into a fighting game. We don't know if it's going to be a 2D fighter. I hope it's a 2D fighter. I hope it looks like the cartoon. No idea if it will. I mean, if this live action version is a huge hit, for Netflix, maybe it'll look more like that. But I'm hoping it really does look like a real 2D, sort of like the Dragon Ball Z fighter we saw last year before. I don't remember how recently that was. Anyway, that's what I'm hoping for. And I think Avatar The Last Airbender has the rich lore. It's not even lore. It's just the number of characters that do different cool stuff that you need for a fighter. I don't think you even need lore for a fighter per se. You just need a number of cool move sets, and man, Last Airbender has that in spades, right? We have all the different benders. We know all the different main characters, and I think it could be really a cool IP to leverage into a fighting game. There are definitely ways they can screw it up, and there have been a number of bad Avatar The Last Airbender video games in the past, so the track record isn't great, but Rich, what do you think? Avatar The Last Airbender as a fighting game? What do you think?
Can I play the Cabbage Merchant?
Oh, just constantly getting hit. you can't attack. You can only absorb damage.
That would not be far from how I generally play fighting games.
I love that idea. I think there should definitely be a Cabbage Vendor cameo at least, or like a
instead of like breaking the car of like breaking the car in Street Fighter, you just have to get it, you know.
Yeah, knock over the I love it. I mean, I want to play as Toph already. Like, let me be a earthbender, and that'd be fun. I just think this would be cool. Christian, you were a fan of the show too? Yeah
I'm curious what it's my initial reaction when I saw this news is it feels like an odd time to come out in terms of the IP's pinnacle of its fandomness. But perhaps this Netflix show will, whether it's good or bad, will get interest in the anime again and kind of the core IP in a way that helps it. Dragon Ball is just kind of forever and there's been so many different seasons, but, and I could be wrong, but in my head, Avatar: The Last Airbender is this one thing. Like it's the story, and I don't know when its peak in popularity is, has been, or will be. So I'm curious to see how this type of IP fares as an IP that perhaps stands the test of time forever with new entries in it, the way I guess Lord of the Rings has, where it's like, oh, well, there's another one of those.
You know, Legend of Korra, you know, yeah. And I supposedly there are like two more things in development, two more. I don't know what they are, but I heard there's like two more Avatar adjacent things that are happening in the next few years. And we'll see how well this live action one does. I've heard various reports, good and bad, about what it could be. So I'm anxious to see the live action one, but I know there's like more animated stuff coming too. So I think the IP is far from dead. And they say this game won't even go into early access until 2025. So it's a ways out, and we don't know exactly what studio is doing it, but I have high hopes. I have high hopes. All right. Let's talk about the games that we have been playing in a segment we call The Playlist. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on The Playlist. Rich, you always come armed with a bevy of really interesting things to talk about.
Yeah.
Where would you like to start? I see you have some really interesting stuff on your playlist.
Yeah. So I think I want to start with a preview, because I've got a game that is still under embargo, but I can briefly talk about what it is. I can't say anything about how I feel about it. So I will try very hard and probably talk slowly so that I can make sure I'm not doing that. But there is a game coming out called The Thaumaturge. Have either of you been clocking this this at all? It is due to come out March 4th, and
I had seen stuff about this. Isn't this kind of? I could be completely misremembering it, but isn't this kind of similar to Disco Elysium in some way, or kind of trying to be the next Disco Elysium? Or am I misremembering?
It's not. I wouldn't say it's quite in that realm. You okay. Might be. There is a game that came out that it was iterating on Disco Elysium that's really good. The name of that particular game is like.
All right, I'm conflating though. So tell me what
it's 11-bit though, right? Publisher. That's the only reason I saw it, because they're Frostpunk, I think. I know that's the publisher, not the developer, but that's why I was like, ooh.
Yeah, they're Frostpunk. And the Thaumaturge is an isometric RPG. It's very story heavy. It's set in Eastern Europe in 1905. The main character is this Polish thaumaturge, and it has vibes. I think one of the times I was on the show here, do you guys remember me talking about a game called Black Book, which was sort of like late 1800s witchcraft thing? This is akin to that in some way, setting wise. It's got this Eastern European Russian setting at a very politically tumultuous time. It does feature political figures, like actual historical figures in it, but has this kind of supernatural underworld with these beings called saluters, who are basically like demonic Pokemon style things that you can sort of recruit as allies. It's got a turn-based combat type of system and plenty of vibes. I think if you go to the trailers, you'll see the vibes, and you'll get a very good sense for what the Thaumaturge is.
It looks great. Visually, it looks really good, which is cool. And it's... I mean, these are my feelings, having not played or to have any preview to it. It has weight to it, I feel like. Sometimes isometric games, and I haven't played it, so I don't know how it feels in the hand, but sometimes I feel like in the isometric game, it will feel like your character skating over something. And at least by the trailer, it looks like you're not in the muck, but in the thick of it. It looks like the characters have weight and presence, which looks really cool.
Oh, it's very, I will say vibe-wise, it is very like you have this cough that you can't shake type of, not literally, but like the feeling is like, oh, I'm slightly sick and maybe I'm a little bit hungover and I'm not feeling well and I'm out in the rain and it has these vibes are, it's very like, there's a lot of stuff that you're just dealing with and you're in this game. And the main character is the titular thaumaturge who can see things about people that other, you know, that other people can't see and has some supernatural powers. If any of these types of feelings and vibes are something that's interesting to you, it's coming out on March 4th. That's what I'll say about the thaumaturge. And I always think it's important when you have, and this is going to come up with some of the other games I'm going to talk about, when you have a game that's not your big AAA marquee release, I always think putting it on the wish list is helpful to people. If you do get it, writing a review, leaving comments are very helpful to get word out about things that you find artistically compelling. I'm going to pivot now over to something else that I've been playing. And let me save the one that Jeff and I are both playing, because that'll be good for us to talk about. And let me instead talk about Astral Ascent. Have either of you played Astral Ascent or had anybody on who's talked about this game at all?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. So Astral Ascent, you guys like Hades, right?
We're not familiar with that game.
Do you like, how about Dead Cells?
Yes, we love Dead Cells.
So here's what I'm going to say about Astral Ascent. And this is going to sound like a pretty big thing, but you know, I back this up. Astral Ascent is a game that is good enough to be in conversation with both of those games.
Ooh.
It has this Hades style roguelike, but it moves more of in a side scrolling 2D way, the way that Dead Cells might move. I will say that it narratively, it does not, like, where Hades will set itself apart from and Dead Cells is narratively, like, Astral Ascent, it's fun. It has fun characters. The basic premise is you are playing one of four characters who are trying to escape from this prison, and the prison is guarded by these beings called Zodiacs, and they are the Zodiacs of Aries, Pisces, Cancer, Taurus, etc., like all the actual Zodiacs, and there's some fun characterizations in there of it. But the real star of Astral Ascent is the gameplay. And I think the first hour you play, it's a little bit like, oh my God, there's so much stuff in this game. What is even happening? How is it even working? But then as soon as you're past that, it is some of the most impressive gameplay I've seen for a roguelike game. And on top of it, the co-op in this game is tremendous. It's a terrific couch co-op game. And I think that that's particularly notable because if you've played these types of games before, then you know that a lot of it is about how balanced the builds are, right? Like you're moving through these levels and you're kind of building what your character can do by finding synergy amongst all the different powers you can get. And Astral Ascent gives you a lot of knobs and whistles to play with that you'll eventually be able to work into your character. So you really have to kind of have this working vocabulary of all the powers that are available, as which you learn as you play it. But that's a delicate balance, right? You're going through something, and if you've got two people, you twice as much damage output that you could put out on the screen. And how do you handle who gets what kind of powers? And are there negotiations? And they've just handled it so beautifully. Like the balance of when the game turns from one player to two player is really noteworthy. And I think when I got this initially, I learned about it from Andrew on Gamers with Jobs, who was raving about it. And he was absolutely right. And I got it and I was playing it solo and it was starting to click for me. And my wife saw me playing it. This is not the type of game that she gravitates towards. She is more of a strategy turn-based style in her games of choice. And she saw that this was co-op and was like, I had it on Switch initially. And she's like, can we get that on PS5 and just co-op that together? And it's been tremendous. It was like the perfect thing for us to do co-op after Baldur's Gate. It really it has been like the go-to game in this house. I almost can't say enough good things about the actual gameplay. And for as messy as the writing is and just kind of all over the place, and there is certainly a lot of characters in it and a lot of like little backstories that are available if people want to look at that stuff and like might be interested in it. I think there's some interesting and fun stuff there, but generally it's like, you'll see the art style of this game. It's beautiful pixel art. And the gameplay is just really great. And once you start to speak its language, this is where I say it's up there with Dead Cells and Hades, and worth having, you know, good enough to be in the conversation with them. Maybe not good enough to surpass them, but certainly good enough to be in the conversation with them. And certainly one of the best couch co-op games I've ever played, particularly in the roguelike genre. So that's my pitch on Astral Ascent. I really think it's worth people checking out.
Very cool.
And our friends Into the Aether, Brendan was really into this game last year. I was like, when you talk about it, Rich, I was like, have I played it? No, I've listened to other people talk about playing it.
Yeah.
But I've heard it's great on Switch too. I know you mentioned getting it on PS5, but I've heard it plays really, really well.
I have
Switch
it on both.
That.
It's I double dipped yeah, awesome. On it because I was playing it solo. On Switch, and the other thing that's really great about it, they've got four different characters, and the characters all work very differently and have their own kind of spell list and their own set of powers, but there's also some shared powers. So there's like a lot of really interesting things going on for what style of game you want to play and what kind of player you are and which character you can gravitate toward, and you can change up their appearance and things like that. There's a lot of like fun stuff with it, for sure. Yeah, Astral Ascent's a gem, and I feel like not enough people talk about it, so I wanted to flag that. It came out late last year. They're still putting out content. They recently put out a whole new set of spells for all the characters. They just like deposited a whole new spell list into people, so it's the developers seem really responsive. It runs buttery smooth, no problems whatsoever. Terrific game.
$20 on Steam right now, it looks like.
Yeah,
and just looking at the videos, it looks like it's kind of both of our jams, Christian. It's got that roguelite stuff for me, and it looks like a lot of side-scrolling precision platforming for you.
If you were going to do a Venn diagram thing, I feel like the three of us, this would be right in the middle of it, right? Like this is like touching on something that I think all three of us particularly are interested in. I also want to touch on another little hidden gem that I think currently has under 100 reviews in Steam. It's in early access. It's about to come out of early access, and that's Ludus Mortis. And Ludus Mortis is a dungeon crawling RPG. So you know what you're doing here. You are rolling up some adventurers, and you're sending them out into a dungeon to fight monsters and get some treasure. The premise for Ludus Mortis is that the senators of Rome to fight the tyrannical Roman emperor resorted to necromancy, which, as we all know, works well and had no problems except for demons and undead. So now you've got this gladiator school, a Ludus, which is Ludus Mortis, is this gladiator school that is specializing in fighting the dead. So you are rolling up a gladiator company, and you're improving your facilities and changing the types of things that you'll have access to. And it has a lot of really fun iterations on the genre. Dungeon RPGs are a particular favorite genre of mine. It's a genre that I have been returning to quite a bit right now. I'm thinking about doing on Gamers with Jobs a series that we'd like to do coming up, is doing a month where everybody talks about one of their favorite genres and brings in somebody who's either worked on one of those games or is also like a huge aficionado of the genre, and just like really diving deep on like what is interesting about this genre, like what makes the dungeon RPG interesting, what are the design challenges in it. And I think Ludus Mortis has a lot of interesting answers to the design challenges.
Just to be clear for folks, this is like a first person kind of Ultima Underworld or the old Bard's Tale or Wizardry games, where you know you're a party, but you are in a first person kind of grid based step forward, and it's one square forward in the dungeon, kind of old school 80s CRPG, right?
Yeah, absolutely. 100% in that category. You are moving one turn at a time. You will encounter monsters will pop up on the screen, and you have your group has to fight them, and you have your front row and your back row, and like the way you manage your rows is important, and the different powers that people can have. There's a lot of fun. They have 14 different classes in this that are all interesting, like really interesting. And what I found that was especially delightful about Ludus Mortis as a modern DRPG is that they let you do the old school rolling. And it's really interesting because they set up the stats where, yes, you know, you want your fighter to have a high strength, but the other stats are also really interesting for other characters and can create some pretty wild combinations. Like, I ended up with a spellcaster who happened to be pretty decent with a bow because they just got the right like the right stat combinations. Like, oh, that's interesting. And this will let this spellcaster reserve their mana a little bit and be able to last a little bit longer. It does a really good job with risk reward. You can change the encounter rate of any dungeon you're in, so you're getting a lot of encounters, and or you can make it so that you have less, and it kind of simulates that going in loud or going in quiet experience that you can get on a tabletop RPG, right? Are we sneaking through this dungeon, or are we just going to go in there and fight all the monsters? And the more monsters that you fight, when you win consecutive battles, you get an experience modifier for the next battle. So you're incentivized to fight a lot, and your experience will go, but then you have a limited amount of resources. Your potions act like Estus flasks for the characters. So once you run out of heals, you're out of heals, right? Like, that's gonna affect how long you stay in the dungeon. And like, do you press on or do you retreat? If you retreat before fulfilling the goal of whatever the mission is, then you're going to take an experience. You're going to take a penalty to the stuff that you've accrued while in the dungeon. So there's some really interesting stuff going on here. It's early access. It seems to have a really responsive dev. I put up a comment because there was something that I was perplexed by in the design, and they're like, oh yeah, we're going to handle that, and we're going to fix that. So that's Ludus Mortis, fascinating game. Also not a lot of people have seen it. So if you're into dungeon RPGs, DRPGs, then check that out.
Cool.
I'm gonna speed through some more here because I'm coming in with a lot of stuff. Because speaking of Ultima, have you guys heard of Moonring at all?
I have not, but you said Ultima, so now I'm excited to hear about this game.
Yeah. Moonring is Ultima, circa Ultima 4 and Ultima 5 specifically is its inspiration point. And guess what, everybody? It's free.
Oh, I have seen this.
It's
free. Sorry, go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, it's terrific. It's completely free. It was made by Dean Carter, who is one of the collaborators on Fable. He came by for an interview on Gamers with Jobs. Totally worth checking out if you want to get some more information about Moonring. I'm going to point you to our feed. Look at that interview we have with Dean Carter. He was terrific to talk to. Moonring is incredible. It has a beautiful design. Like I said, it looks like Ultima 4, Ultima 5, but it's really, it also has this roguelike lair to it because you have the overworld map and that's all set, but when you go into dungeons, it's random. Like, it has that rogue quality to the dungeoneering in it, which is really fascinating and a whole lot of fun. It features a fantasy world that is utterly singular. I have not seen a world like this, and it is a game that is very practiced in restraint. When you play Moonring, you are discovering all sorts of wild things about the world, about the way the gods work in the world, even like things like magic. Like, the game, you don't really know how that's going to work, and then when you find out, it's delightful. It's a truly delightful and surprising game. And if you're somebody who grew up on Ultimas, I think it's particularly that era of Ultima, right? Like the Ultima 4, Ultima 5.
Yeah,
I think this is going to hit your nostalgia vibes real hard. terrific music too. Really dig Moonring, and it's free. So it's like, you also, the only thing it costs you to try it is your time. So it's can't ask for anything better than that. I think now we should probably pivot to Ultros.
I think I installed Moonring and never started it. I think somebody told me about this and I installed it. And I think it just got lost in my library and I never have tried it. And now I'm going to, try it.
You need to try this. You of all people, Jeff.
So funny. I know. It's just totally made for me. And it's, like you said, it's free. I think I just installed it and forgot. Anyway, let's talk about Ultros, because you and I have both been playing Ultros. Christian, do you know about this game? This feels like a game you would be aware of and know. It's Metroidvania.
Yeah, I think we might have talked about it after, was it a State of Play? It was shown somewhere, and we were blown away by its psychedelic, you know, blacklight poster aesthetic, totally, so to speak. But I have not played it, so I'm excited to hear about it.
Yeah, psychedelic is the word for the visuals of Ultros. It is a sort of classic Metroidvania side-scrolling two-dimensional action platformer. But visually looks like nothing you've ever seen before. I mean, it is really just wild how far they push the visual elements. The backgrounds are really busy and crazy, and the creatures are all bizarre and kind of non-standard, just wild ideas behind things. The character model is strange. Everything just looks really, it's got this almost kind of cyberpunky mixed with kind of a what's the guy, Existenz, who's the director of Existenz, you know, like that kind of like bio body horror kind of weird. It's cool. It's got a cool look to it, I think. Striking.
It's got that like biomechanical, like the ship that you're in is called the sarcophagus, and it's all biomechanical, and it's a really, I think Metroidvanias are of course or Castlevanioids for those of you who prefer them that way. I think there's a risk, I think, with them that there's a lot of, it is very tired ground right now. So the thing that I've been responding to in Ultros is that it's doing something very different with some of those core gameplay elements and then adding its own weird twists. Like, I love the fact that this is a game about like eating weird critters and plants, and that is how you level up and getting like different nutrients to unlock different powers. And then like that's also the healing mechanic. It's totally wild.
It's interesting. So just to be clear for folks that may not be aware of this game, the you are slicing away at baddies, and these little critters, you can attack them in a variety of ways. You have kind of a cool dash that lets you kind of dash through the enemy, and then that kind of it combos right into this like follow-up attack with a different button on your controller. And you've got a variety of different things to do. And the game really wants you to mix up your attacks and do things in a, not just spam the same button, but really kind of craft your attacks and try not to repeat any one attack against an enemy. And if you manage to do that, you will destroy it in such a way that it leaves behind a pristine bit of goop, some sort of remnant, little body element that comes off of these creatures. But if you just spam the light attack button, you can defeat the enemy, but it'll give you a piece of loot that is damaged or broken in some way. It'll drop like a spleen, you know, or some bits of offal that are not ideal. And so you can eat them and it'll heal you. You can also use the same bits that fall off the creatures to level up. There are these save points that allow you to eat different nutrients that fill in certain stats that once they've hit a certain threshold, let you level up and put points in this cool skill tree. So I think it's a really neat push and pull in that the same thing that is basically a health potion is the same currency that lets you level up. So there's this kind of like, oh, do I want to, you know, gobble up this bit of goop that fell off this monster now, or do I want to wait and use this later to be able to level myself up? I think that's kind of a neat, neat push and pull.
And for an extra,
and also the fact, sorry, go ahead.
Oh yeah. For just like an extra fun twist on that is this game also has gardening elements where you can find yes. different seeds and grow different psychedelic plants and then eat them, and they'll have different effects, and they can also replace the monster nutrients. Like some of the powers are that you can unlock are like stealth powers. You could totally play Ultros in a pacifist style if you wanted. I like you could just grow your food and kind of move through the
world.
I don't
know completely. I think you still have to beat the bosses, but yes. Yeah. I mean, I think it's I think the bosses are where everything kind of like they set aside like, okay, you just smack the boss however you want to smack them, and that's fine. Anyway, but yes, it is really interesting. There is this kind of there's these patches of land that let you grow things, and that can open up new traversal elements in the map and stuff like that. I was super into this game up until I died. I didn't die up until I got to a certain story beat and everything reset, because yeah. this game also has an element of something that's also very much in vogue right now, which is that Groundhog Day, one day repeating thing. It's got some roguelike elements to it, which, hey, I'm Mr. Roguelike. I love a roguelike. Unfortunately, the way it's executed here really turned me off from the game, because what it does is it's not that when I die, basically the game starts, you wake up on a spaceship. You don't know how you got there. You're trying to figure it out, right? You go, 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 go. And at a certain point, it starts over and you wake up again on the ship. And I was like, oh, cool. Lots of games have used this as a way to justify when I die, I get reborn and I have to, you know, I this roguelite stuff. Well, that's not exactly what Ultros is doing. Ultros says when you die, you respawn at a save point. So it's not that. But when you get to a certain story point, you get reborn and you've lost everything you've done. Everything. All the upgrades you've done, all of the new skills that you acquired, even your little robot friend that like gives you double jump and things that are very, very necessary. And you have to reacquire those things in the next run. And there are certain shortcuts that get introduced, but it really turned me off, because every time that happened, I was like, ugh, I do not want to do this. I don't want to lose my double jump, lose other traversal things that I've really gotten used to and like, and I earned on all the things that I got that I liked. And there are sometimes it's like, even to go pick up my friend, my little robot friend who gives me a lot of these things back, is a chore. And it felt to me like a chore, and it made me really turn off to a game that I was really digging. But it sounds like you didn't have that problem.
Yeah. I just don't get that feeling very often in games. And a lot of it is you're generally speaking, the power curve is like number go up, right? Like that's the thing. And I found it interesting for this game, the way that they would handle that they made this choice. Like it feels very deliberate. And from like a design perspective, I think it's a challenging choice. And I think it's going to make it difficult for some people to push through, because it's just not what we're used to. But I don't necessarily think it's bad. I think a lot of times it's very easy when we're not used to a game design decision, because it's just not in vogue for a variety of perfectly reasonable reasons, to be like, oh, this is what are they doing here? I'm going to turn it down. But I actually think there's something to that discomfort and in that pushback from the game that I think is worth checking out. I would say that if you are somebody who's interested in Metroidvanias, I think Ultros is doing something very different. And this is what I meant when I kind of hinted at that earlier, because it is playing with something here, and I'm not far enough into it yet to totally see how that comes together, but there's enough that it's done right. And it's so pretty to look at that. I I'm willing to, it's the type of thing where like I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt that they can pull that together and make that an overall satisfying experience, even though that is going to be a hard beat to I think for a lot of people to navigate in the moment. So, but now you know that it's coming, listeners. Yeah. So sorry for the spoilers.
No, I don't think, I mean, it comes fairly quickly and repeatedly many, many times. But I do agree with you that it is gorgeous to look at and really stands out in that way. And I think even just like it's more zoomed in than you usually are.
Yes.
Like your character is larger than you usually are in these types of games. Like everything feels different in it. And I think in that sense, I really respect it a lot. It is going for something different.
It feels like that drug trip. Like it really does. Like, yeah. Like the zooming in contributes to that. And there's also like the pace at which you walk, the more you start walking forward, like you speed up a little bit. And there's just some really interesting rhythmic choices with how everything moves and where the camera is that I just really appreciate because I don't see people take those types of swings generally.
I think the animation is beautiful. I think Lana would really love looking at this game as well as an animator. It is, you know, it's goopy, you know, it's a goopy game in like the best possible way. You know, everything is kind of slimy and gross and everything, you know, you smack stuff and it kind of explodes and splatters everywhere. And it's not blood per se, but it's just like alien muck, you know, there's it's very satisfying. Everything, you know, feels like it's sticky. It's an impressive art direction, I think, for Ultros. I just was frustrated a bit by being constantly thrown back to ground zero and being like, I gotta go fetch my stuff that I already earned, you know? Anyway. There you go. Rich is a very cool, eclectic list. This is why I love having you on the show, Rich. It's such an awesome group of games that you have brought to our attention, most of which we had not spoken about at all on the show, and really, really love that. One game we have spoken a lot about, Christian, I know is on your playlist this week because I was playing it a lot with you.
We played a lot of Helldivers 2. Folks can watch a Let's Play of you, Lana, and myself playing it over on the Patreon. We did because we decided to do it. We had a prompt up for a paid DLC that was like, do folks plan stuff or do you kind of just do stuff on a whim? And we got some great responses and kind of using that as our excuse. And also because it was Valentine's Day, we decided we were going to do something on a whim and do our paid DLC episode as a Let's Play of the three of us playing Helldivers, which there is the VOD on the Patreon, but we also released just the audio version of it, which is a trip.
Which a number of people have said was a delight to listen to. Yeah, I don't know how that's possible.
Some people loved it. We also got some feedback that was like, hey, I love you all, but as an audio only listener, nah, dog, yeah, which I totally understand.
Theater of the mind. It was theater of the mind, yeah, we like to call it. You could hear the sound effects of Helldivers and long bouts of silence and then us going, hey, what? You shot me. Theater of the mind.
I still love Helldivers 2. There have been more connection errors. I think there was an error thrown up. It was like, our servers are full. We are so sorry, y'all. Message that came up.
Actually,
but
Christian, let me read us an email because we got an email to this effect. We got an email to this effect. And I think to be fair, because you and I, we love this game. We've been singing its praises. A lot of people have loved it, but you were correct to bring up some of those issues. And I want to read an email that we got. This comes from Zach, who sent this email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. Zach says, I bought the $60 edition of Helldivers 2 on PC on Friday. It is now Sunday morning. Because the servers have been at capacity, I haven't been able to log into the game for a single moment. No tutorial, no nothing. I've not even made it to the menu screen. It's frustrating because I love the first Helldivers and I really wanted to support this developer, but I've never had this happen before. I wish the developer could have had included an offline mode so that the game is not completely locked out of, I'm not completely locked out at server capacity, but no dice. Let me at least play a tutorial or single player would have been ideal if the servers weren't having issues. I keep telling myself to be patient, but I've never had this happen where I bought a game that is completely inaccessible 10 days after launch, a victim of its own popularity. Some of my friends have had better luck getting into the game. Some swear by staying queued for as long as it takes, while others swear by restarting the game to get in. I've not had luck with either. I guess I'll be patient, but it sucks. The FOMO is real. So I just wanted to respect the fact that people are having that situation. This is a holiday weekend here in the United States. It's President's Day weekend. So a lot of people, I think, are hunkering down and playing Vidya games, which, you know, more power to them. But that's causing some problems for Helldivers 2 at the moment. We have been fortunate to be able to play at weird times. So I haven't really experienced any queues, but I know this weekend it has gotten bad. So I just wanted to throw that out there because Zach is having that issue. And to be fair, you know, that does suck. It does suck.
It does suck. I feel for the devs. They've been pretty vocal about it, saying, you know, we had no idea. Not that we had no idea, but this exceeded wildest expectations. It's Sony's most concurrent played game on PC. I think having the PC release was huge for them. Also coming out this year, I think it's right time, right place. It's a really good game. I don't want to say last year it would have floundered, but I think it's a lot of right time, right place. Having that PC day one, I think, is huge. But the devs have been public about saying, we're hiring. We are hiring more people. We're ramping up servers. We're doing our best. And I feel for them because on this show, we are big fans of not crunching. And sometimes even when a game comes out, developers still suffer from crunch. And
certainly in this situation.
Yeah. Hats off to the devs. And well,
another thing, Christian, that they mentioned this week, the devs, which I find pretty exciting as somebody who's digging this game a lot, is basically their entire roadmap that they had in mind has been completely rewritten, or they're in the process of rewriting. They're like, we had a roadmap of the stuff we wanted to do. The success of this game means that we have rethought the roadmap completely and we're trying all kinds of new stuff. So I think that's pretty cool, but it also means, man, a bit of chaos over there.
Yeah.
Super fun game. And you can get
super
in.
Super fun game. I want to mention two other retro replays, and I do want to carve out a little bit of VR talk specifically for you, Jeff, but also for our listeners, something that I've been spending some time with in VR. But the two retro replays I want to hit on real quick, Halo Reach I bought. It was on sale on Steam for $10 for the Master Chief Collection, I believe. I bought the whole Master Chief Collection. It runs great on Switch. Multiplayer stuff. I'm on Switch. It's on Switch now? Oh, Xbox is over. On Steam Deck. It runs great on Steam Deck. And the reason I want to highlight it is I think while the first game in the story arc of Halo, the last game, I believe, of Bungie's run of Halo, I think last, maybe three, I don't know, around their last, phenomenal use of enemy encounter, like kill boxes, story moments, and rest. And the Bungie-developed Halo games were always renowned for their sandbox style of gameplay moments and having these bombastic, kind of figure it out your way moments. And I think what they achieved in Halo Reach is really a masterclass of bringing some of that more cinematic storytelling elements to it, where you are a member of this squad of Spartans, but still retaining those playground style kill environments, shoot 'em up areas, and then resting those moments and making you hungry for more. Absolutely phenomenal game that holds up to this day. If you haven't played it, I think it's worth playing from an understanding of the industry aspect of what the first person shooter genre has become and evolved from. And two, it is a little weird to not have left trigger, right trigger. Like, I almost have a hard time balancing my Steam Deck because you don't aim down the scopes the same way. It has its own Halo-esque control still before they shifted in Infinite or whatever that shift happened. But Halo Reach, phenomenal game. The other game that is very much kind of in line with this of me looking at, and maybe I'm teasing Season 3 feeling this stuff. Alex, I haven't reached out to you yet, but maybe I am. Maybe I'm already teasing Season 3 feeling this conversations. Is Batman Arkham Knight. I love the Arkham games. I went back and started replaying all of them. Some of them work well on Steam Deck, some don't. Arkham Knight I'm actually playing on PC because I got it free on Epic Game Store at some point. And I think it's really interesting to look at this game, Jeff, based on our conversation surrounding Spider-Man 2, and similar to how I talked about Halo Reach and having its shoot 'em up environments and then resting that core gameplay loop and how it makes you hungry for more. I feel like Arkham Knight, even when it came out, was one of the first games where the discourse around it was the Batmobile stinks. Like, we understand why the Batmobile is perhaps in the game, but I don't want to do that. Let me just Batman. And our conversation around Spider-Man 2, a lot of that was about, we like the emotional through line of some of these side missions, perhaps, and we like the stories they're telling, but also let me Spider-Man, you know, let me not, don't take me out of the core idea of that hero fantasy. And I think it's really fascinating what Batman Arkham Knight tried to do while retaining that hero fantasy and doing something that perhaps Batman does do, is zoom around in a Batmobile and take things out, but in a way that didn't feel satisfying to players of that franchise. And so to our community, as much as to you, Rich, or Jeff, is this idea of what do we want in these games? Would it be better if it was just 8 hours and it was just Batman, 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 Batman? Or is there a way that is satisfying to rest that core gameplay loop? And what do we want that to be? Because I feel like now in the middle of this PS5, Xbox Series generation, I think we're still struggling with that. I think we still see games struggle with that idea of here's this core gameplay loop, but if we only have the game be that for 20 hours or whatever we feel the game quote needs to be, it gets exhausting, but we also don't know what this other stuff should be. So replaying, I'm probably 70% through Arkham Knight now again. And it's been really interesting to see just how much Batmobile is in it.
It's a lot of Batmobile.
It's a lot of Batmobile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very interesting that you're doing that, going back and checking those out. So that's what's on Christian's playlist. I have also played a lot of Helldivers 2. And Ultros, we talked about. I want to talk about a game I mentioned when the demo hit as having getting its claws into me. I'm curious, Rich, have you heard of or played Balatro?
I feel like I've heard this name come up. Maybe I actually heard you talk about it at one point.
It's possible. I did talk at length about it because this game is crack. This one, I think, might be one you might want to introduce to your wife, or maybe you don't. If you ever want to see her again. But you said she likes the turn-based type of stuff. Balatro, and this could be a turnoff for some, Balatro is based loosely around poker, the poker hands. So I tried to introduce my friend Anthony Carboni to this because I felt like he would love it. He's like, I don't care about poker. I don't want to play a poker game. I'm like, okay, fair. That's a fair point. If you're not into poker, it's not poker. But you kind of have to enjoy at least the aesthetic of poker. And honestly, it has a sort of a cheesy Vegas slot machine aesthetic to it, which I find very charming. It's all pixel art. Single person developed this game, by the way. One human made Balatro, every part of it, my understanding. But this is an extremely addictive game for me and people like me because the thing I love about video games in general, but specifically turn-based games, is juicy decisions, like great decisions, right? You want to find wonderful decisions. And Balatro is just a waterfall. It is drinking from this fire hose of decisions. You just have so many options at your disposal all the time of really cool things you could do. Now, how do you play Balatro? Okay, Balatro is basically make a rad poker hand, score points. That's the entire game. You face basically kind of opponents or bosses. You know, there's steps to a boss, and each time you are facing off against a minimum point value you have to achieve in a certain number of hands. And you have a bunch of cards that come up, and you can make poker hands out of them. You can make a pair. You can make two pair. You can make a full house. You can make straight, any poker hand, right? And you have a number of ways that you can sort of manipulate the point values of those hands. You can discard cards and draw new ones to try to facilitate the poker hand you're looking at. But the most interesting thing you're doing is you're working with a number of jokers. There are these jokers that you can acquire and equip that will then give you all kinds of wacky things. There's 150 different jokers in the game. And it works like a roguelite in that you're doing these runs. How far can you go? How long can you last on a run? How many times can you face off against an opponent by getting the minimum score and keep going? And as you do that, you accrue more and more of these jokers that allow you to manipulate your point values in interesting ways, add multipliers, or do kinds of wacky, crazy things where, you know, if you have hearts in your hand, those score way higher. Or, I mean, there's 150 of them, so there's just tons
of. Does one of them tell you that we live in a society?
Yes, the Joker. That is the Joker. Yes. Also, I mean, I don't even need to tell you. There's a million things you can do. You can open packs that let you manipulate the actual cards in your hand. You can change the style of cards. You can turn cards into stone and glass and all kinds of cool, weird things you can do. You can also decide to just skip a battle entirely and take this bonus. Like if you skip a battle, usually in games, it would be like, if you skip a battle, you'd get a penalty, but you didn't have to make that battle. In Balatro, if you skip a battle, you get something cool. You get an awesome thing. So you're tempted to skip the battle. But if you skip the battle, you won't get the cool reward at the end of the battle, which is money that you can then spend to upgrade your stuff. So you're kind of like, well, is this cool upgrade for skipping the battle better than what I would be able to buy with the money if I succeed at the battle? Am I like screwing myself by pushing things off farther, getting closer to that boss battle faster? There's so many awesome choices to be made all the time. And you're just constantly, do I get this hand now? My total number of hands is dwindling. What do I do? Do I discard? I have a finite number of discard opportunities as well. Do I use a discard to try to hope that I draw the card that'll give me that sick straight flush that I'm looking for? You know, all of these cool decisions upon decisions upon decisions, but then how do I build my deck? Which jokers do I have in play? Do I do a hand that actually procs one of these cool jokers that lets me do this other thing? It's just like pure concentrated decision making and compulsion. It's very, very good game. It's called Balatro. It's come out of early access. It is in full release now. I cannot recommend it to anybody that wants to have free time.
In case anybody who was watching the live stream saw me jump suddenly, it's because I did go to take a peek at this game, and then for some reason, like my Steam volume came on at full blast, so I was suddenly hearing the music, and it startled me. But it looks really neat, and it does look like the type of thing that I would find incredibly addictive. When this little one act festival that I'm in ends, then maybe I can check this out, because it's hard to see, like, seeing you get passionate about poker mechanics.
I know, it's weird.
Is making me like, okay, well that gives me pause.
It's weird. It's to look at the game, you go like, what's so special about this? But if you play it, it will eat your hours.
I can kind of feel it. You know, like you ever just look at something and I'm like, ooh, I look at this. It doesn't look like anything, but I feel the hours that will be eaten. You know, like
it's just pure mechanics. It's like it is distilled to its base purity. It's beautiful. Balatro is the name of the game. All right.
For folks who are listening to this right when it came out, right when this episode comes out, on Steam it says Balatro comes out February 20th. So you might have a few hours to wait. Oh,
forgive me. I got a code. But I believe it is leaving early access.
Imminent, yes.
Yes, yes.
It's all leaving early access when my play opens. So come and see my play or go play Balatro.
Yeah, you know, that sounds like an evening. 1-2 punch. Right? Yeah. Come home to Balatro. All right. We're already super long, but I know we want to do a couple of other things. Christian has a VR game to talk about, so let's get into it. Virtual reality. VR. Virtual reality. Hit me, Christian.
So it's less of a game and more of a mod for my PSVR 2 headset, which maybe I finally did because I didn't buy an Apple Vision Pro and I don't have a Quest 3, and the PSVR 2 is the best headset that I have. And I love this headset. And so I had been reading about the Globular Cluster CMP2 for a while on Reddit. And thank you. And other forums talking about making the PSVR 2 more comfortable. PSVR 1, perhaps the most comfortable headset I've ever worn. PSVR 2, not the most comfortable headset I've ever worn. And so I was a little gun shy to pick this up because it requires you using one of those plastic, you know, kind of screwdriver wedge things and unclipping the stock headset from your PSVR 2. Can I grab this? Let me see if I can. Got it. It's on a cord. Will it make it? It is. So it adds a much bigger back pad piece to this PSVR 2 headset. Much bigger back. And then also you have different fronts, and it has center weight, a top strap as well. Looks maybe a little more dorky, but
I mean,
holy.
I'm surprised at how many goggly eyes he has on that.
It is. It's the most comfortable headset I've ever worn now. It is incredible. I have my racing wheel is usually kind of tucked away in a corner. It has just been living out here in my office now because I have been using my PSVR 2 nonstop for long stretches of time. I'm secretly just doing time trials on Willow Springs in Gran Turismo 7 because that's the next track day I plan to do in real life. And I've never been able to do the virtual version of a track that I actually get to drive a real car on. And now I'm like, I know it's not one-to-one, but I'm going to memorize all these turns and I'm going to do this thing, and I can stay in the headset for hours without discomfort. It is mind-blowing.
Globular cluster?
I think I bought it for like $40 on Amazon or something like that. Nice. It's like $40 to $50. I did it in maybe 5 minutes it took to pry the old thing off and put the new thing on. Night and day. And even somehow it sits better on my face, so it keeps it in the sweet spot better, which is very small in the PSVR 2. But the light seals also get closer to my face where it is virtually perfect. I cannot recommend it enough. The Globular Cluster CMP2, which I think is the second revision of this
thing. Rolls off the tongue.
I think it's a must buy.
When I hear something called something like a globular cluster, and
I picked one of those up in Ultros.
Yeah, you pick one of those up in Ultros. You have to eat the right kind of animals, and then you get a globular cluster. This is like one of those things that just makes me wish time travel was possible so that you could travel back in time and see yourself as a child and be like, kid, globular cluster, and then disappear. And then you'll be like haunted by that for your entire life until you find it. You're like, oh, there were so many other more important things that happened to me, but it's weird that I did this to myself and pranked me in this way.
Kid me would have assumed that was a breakfast cereal. Oh, globular clusters? That sounds delicious.
I could go back in time and tell myself either about virtual reality or a comfort mod for my headset. And yes, I choose
I would not worth owning
a PSVR 2 without a globular cluster.
Just tell me to buy Apple stock, you idiot.
No, buy this comfort mod instead. If you're still using your PSVR 2 regularly, Jeff, or dear listener, I truly think it is a must buy. It's the best money I've spent.
Can I tell you something? Totally straight up, I use my PSVR 2 the least because of how uncomfortable it is. Honestly, it hurts my nose at this point. And to be fair, I put in I bought third party inserts for glasses, and I know that has added weight, and so it's not entirely the PSVR 2's fault. But
this is even more required than it.
Cluster this bad boy up. It's gonna help.
I would be willing to guarantee it, Jeff. If you put this on and it doesn't make it significantly more comfortable for you, just say Rich sent me and Rich will buy you an Xbox.
That's the globular guarantee. Very cool. Globular cluster CMP2. I'm gonna buy one. All right. I know we're already long, Rich. I appreciate you hanging out with us. I know you're probably exhausted, but I need to hear about this tabletop game. And as we know, the people have been chanting the tabletop time.
We cannot disappoint the people.
We cannot. Here it comes.
Right now.
I saw this on our little rundown here, and I Googled it, and I may be purchasing this. So you got to tell me, should I purchase yes. this game?
Also, okay. The creator of this game, Will Petre, was on our show and was just a delightful human being to talk to. So Social Alchemix is this game here. And Will's background is as a bartender and mixologist. So he's sort of brought a little bit of that to what is essentially a very simple social game with a series of kind of alchemical symbols, and you line them up and that leads you to a page, and it lets you ask a question of the people that you're with. And the idea is you're supposed to have these cocktails or whatever. If you don't drink, you can, you know, have some sort of delightful thing to, like, you know, you're sitting down with friends and or strangers and having an active conversation with some really interesting, thoughtful questions. And there's a timer in the game, but, like, one of the fun things is the timer is actually not like you don't have to say your story or answer the question by the time the timer ends. You have to spend at least as much time as is in the timer talking about the question. So it's like it's actually cool. Like a minimum and not a maximum, which is a really neat inversion. And
that's what Xbox should have used for their business update, you know?
And they're really good questions. Like they're very thoughtful. They're the types of things that can, you know, like, what is the path that you didn't take? It's like these types of things. And the questions are all kind of thematically tied to these alchemical symbols that are like when you make the combination of things, they're all within the realm that is being covered by that. Like, and Will did a lot of research on alchemy and things like that. So it's got this like neat little design flourish to what is essentially like an excellent cocktail game. He did it in New York City as a theatrical experiment with strangers and had people like witnessing the conversation happening, which was also apparently very successful and really neat. I didn't get to see that. But it was a real delight stumbling into this game. I discovered it the way that most people discover games, by running into Will at a reading of a new translation of Uncle Vanya and in an apartment, and, you know, just like as you do, and just like getting to talk to him for a little bit, and then realizing that we were in the same movie, like way back in the aughts. At one point, just some like wild coincidences, like, yeah, oh, you were in the Rising Up zombie movie with, yeah, that's like wild. Of course, you can't recognize somebody when they're zombified and they're in zombie makeup, so that's but yeah, it's Social Alchemix is delightful, and I think it's going to be a good if you're somebody who does party games or social games, it's a good one to have on hand. It's a good neat extra flavor of that, and it is really about cultivating conversation and community. Will is a very thoughtful person too, so there's ways to interact with it in ways, like if you have things you don't want to talk about, like you have boundaries that you can put out, and it's just like a really good simple game, and I think more people should know about it, so I'm passing it along.
I'm buying it right now. This seems so perfect for situations I'm in these days, where I'm in a relatively new city. I've only been here a couple of years, and meeting parents of classmates of my children and getting into sort of, you know, new social situations. I think this would be great to have on hand. So I'm buying it.
I think the thing that's really neat about it is if you have people that you know have known for a long time and you have an established dynamic with, it disrupts that dynamic and gives you like an attempt to like re-explore that ground.
Yeah.
And then it's also just such a great ice-breaking game at the same time. Like if you're meeting new people, and it's one of those games that's not very gamey. By which I mean, right, not that it tastes like rabbit, but by which I mean
nobody wins, right?
It's one of those things where people who don't play games will enjoy playing this, right, or people who think of themselves as people who don't enjoy playing games will enjoy playing this game. If that makes sense.
That's great. Yeah. Social Alchemix is what it's called. You can find it online by searching for Social Alchemix, socialalchemix.com. All right. What an awesome episode. So much fun. Rich Lovejoy, thank you for being with us.
Oh my God, thank you guys for having me.
Of course. Always welcome here. Always bring such interesting stuff to talk about. Love hearing you. Tell the folks where they can keep up with you and all the cool stuff you do online, including Lovejoy on Lovejoy.
Yeah, so Lovejoy on Lovejoy, if you go to chaintheater.org, it's program number 12. The discount code is LOVE, just all caps, LOVE. You can get the virtual ticket for the 25th. The show also runs, it opens on Tuesday, the 20th, and there's also a show on March 1st. You can also find me on the Gamers with Jobs conference call podcast, which is a Canadian gaming podcast that I randomly stumbled into co-hosting several years ago and could not be happier to be doing so. Cause life does some funny things sometimes. And that's where you can find me. I would sincerely love for anyone to see the work going on with Lovejoy on Lovejoy, because I do want to emphasize it's a real, I think, an important story for right now. And I'm terrified and nervous. I'm out of practice doing a play like this. I've had since the pandemic started. You know, I've done a couple of little plays, and we have something in New York City called It's Getting Tired, Mildred, which is a soap opera for the stage that happens monthly. Very different than this. That's a very, you get the script like a couple days beforehand and you're doing a full soap opera. So yeah, you can also see me in that, I guess. Wow. If you're in New York City, I play Lancaster Milton, the cult leader / FBI agent / jazzercise enthusiast.
Amazing.
That's also a delightful show, very different than Lovejoy on Lovejoy. And yeah, find me in Gamers with Jobs, see Lovejoy on Lovejoy, see the soap opera for the stage if you live in New York, and find my movies and stuff. I'm also in movies.
Very cool. That
industry is dying. I mean, every industry that's dying.
Yeah, that's your wheelhouse. That's your
that's my wheelhouse.
I'm right there with you. Christian Spicer, what about you? What do you got going on this week?
I'm on Threads and Instagram as Christian_Spicer. This show is also on Threads and Instagram as DLC Hype Train. And this show is also on YouTube at DLC Pod, where we put up video segments from the show. Tuesdays and Thursdays in the morning is when they post up each and every week. And then I write a newsletter all about video games, casual conversational style newsletter about video games called Let's Chat Games that folks can find at christianspicer.substack.com. It's fun.
It is. You can find me on socials at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. I also do the Film Cast about movies and television shows. We Have Concerns, a comedy science show, and the Fan Controlled Show, which is a show about sports on the Fan Controlled Sports and Entertainment Networks. Also, the DLC Book Club is going strong. We had an awesome talk, our third, with author Steven Erickson, who I just want to be. He is the coolest person on the planet. I love him so very much. A genius. I think indisputable genius. And you can check that out on my YouTube page, which is youtube.com/Kanata Jeff. All right, let's wrap the show up now with our parting gifts. Hey, give us a suggestion. Rich, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
Oh, boy. Do I ever. So I'm going to recommend a book called Nestlings from Nat Cassidy. Nat is another, I've kind of made a little theme of some of the things I'm sharing here. Another person I've met through independent theater who is an extremely talented person. And Nestlings is his second horror novel. He's a big fan of Stephen King, and Nestlings is just such a delightful read. And usually, like, you get something like your friend publishes a novel, you read it, and you're like, cool, I'm really glad they did this. You know, I support them. I find the things that I love about it. But this book is a total page turner. You know, even if I did not know Nat in person, like, I would I would still love this book. Like, it's a really gripping from page one book. The basic premise is a young couple who have just had their first child, but it was something of a complicated birth process. And one of them is in a wheelchair as a result of going through a complicated labor process. And they're down on their luck in a lot of ways. They've just had one of the worst years imaginable. And suddenly their luck changes a little bit, and they win a housing lottery to this kind of exclusive building in New York. And it is terrifying from moment one. It's a really scary book. If you're into horror books, you will love Nestlings. It is also something that Nat has described as was one of the impetuses for writing this, is thinking about, you know, if you watch a vampire, like say you watch like a vampire movie and you see somebody pull out a cross and they use the cross to scare the vampire away, you know, you might just say, oh yeah, that's just like a thing. But how does that make you feel if you're not Christian, right? Like, so like, what is the, this is sort of the other neat thing about Nestlings, is it is a very interesting Jewish take on the vampire myth. It's not exactly what it is, but that is like what a lot of the inspiration is. I don't want to go into saying too much more about it, 'cause I don't want to spoil anything. I think it's a really fantastic read though. So check that out. It's an easy read. It's also got an audiobook that is read by Nat, who's a terrific performer in his own right.
Again, that is Nestlings by Nat Cassidy. And that's Rich's parting gift. Christian Spicer, what about you?
Slow Horses on Apple TV Plus. I don't know if you guys talked about it on Filmcast. I know Mr. David Chen is a fan of the show. Mm-hmm. I had it on my watch list for a very long time and then just never got around to for the longest of time. And my wife and I have dove in now. It's incredible. I feel like it was maybe advertised to me the wrong way. The premise that I had in my head when I added it to my watch list was it's like a bumbling MI5 agent. It's like the no good, right? British spies. Oh, they're, and I pictured it not necessarily being Mr. Bean, but also not being Mr. Bean, you know, kind of like the Suicide Squad of MI5, you know, like it's like they get the job done, but oopsie daisy. It's not that. It is heart-pounding, thriller, British espionage at the highest level. Like, yes, the Slow Horses are a group that maybe had made mistakes in the past in some form or fashion, but the show is not humdum, mistake-ridden crew stumbles their way into success. Riveting, heart-pounding, so well acted, an incredible cast, many of whom folks might know, but everyone you don't know, you'll go, ah, what do I know them from? You know, it's that kind of collection of people that is always from somewhere or something. It's a 10 out of 10 show. And I think a lot of folks have probably missed it because it is on Apple TV Plus, and in my humble opinion, misadvertised or misrepresented in its advertising.
Yeah, two seasons now, right?
I think the second season, I don't know if it's out or announced. We did season one and I haven't clicked over to see if there is a season two, but it's great.
I got to give this one a chance. I was turned off by what I assumed was the premise as well. So maybe
I had the same exact experience. And then I briefly thought it was like a concert video where Band of Horses and Slow Dive were playing together. But it wasn't that.
It's Gary Oldman. Like that's why I shortlisted it. Right. But I agree.
He's done Slow some Horses bad stuff though. Let's be honest.
Yeah. I mean, who hasn't?
Not always a
home
run.
I did most of this week's episode, you know? So like we all.
That's right. Fair.
The whole part of this week's episode.
People say Christian Spicer, the Gary Oldman of video game podcasters.
Look, there was this episode when Rich wasn't talking and I was messing it up. And then there was the fascinating stuff that Rich was saying. So we're all part of a stinker. You know, we have other people carry it for us.
Hey, my parting gift is something that we've talked about a lot on the show. We've talked about unions a lot on the show. Christian and I, big supporters of unionization efforts across every industry, but more specifically the video game industry. And one is happening right now. I got an email from our friend Rebecca Valentine, who's been a friend of the show been on three or four or five times maybe now at this point. And she wanted to let us know that IGN is unionizing. Hopefully you've already heard about this, but they're unionizing over at IGN, and you can actually sign a petition right now to urge Ziff Davis to acknowledge their union and accept it wholeheartedly. You can do that by going to a very clumsy URL. If you just Google it, you'll find it, the IGN union. You can get there. It is Action Network is the place.org is the place, but it's hard to find. If you go to actionnetwork.org, it's not immediately apparent on the site where it is. So you need a link, but worth Googling, worth adding your name to the petition. I want to thank Isaac C for emailing us also and letting us know that he supports the union at IGN. We are big fans of this notion, and we are rooting for this to go through and go through smoothly. And you can sign your name. I already have. I hope you will too, over at actionnetwork.org. So check it out. Check it out. We're going to try to get Rebecca on again to talk about it, and maybe some other folks from IGN. We'll see how that works out scheduling wise, but there are a little over 80 of them, folks who work there, and 87% of those have already signed authorization cards. And they're just asking for voluntary recognition from Ziff Davis. So
it's the IGN Creators Guild will help you find it as well as the name of the specific union.
Thanks. All right. We have a listener suggested parting gift. This comes to us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. It comes from Colin. Colin writes, "Hearing you talk about the boom and bust of video game companies reminded me of a 2010 music video called Fear the Boom and Bust. The video depicts a rap battle between John Maynard Keynes and Friedrich von Hayek, two economists who have had a major impact on current economic thought. I'm not an economist, but to me, the video does an excellent job of breaking down complex theories in an interesting and digestible way. Think epic rap battles of history, but with a bit more substance. There's one line in the song about the fact that the soaring increases we see when times are good are not real growth and make the crashes worse when they eventually follow. That feels pretty close to your complaint about the surge in growth of projects when times are good that get axed when the interest rates tick up. Love the show. Thanks so much, Colin." I hadn't seen this. This is pretty old, but I had not seen this, and it's pretty good. If you like complex subjects delivered to you in rap form, and who, let's be honest, who does not? Who does not? I recommend Googling Fear the Boom and Bust rap video. It's clever. Well done. Well done. Thank you, Colin, for bringing it to our attention. If you'd like to have your parting gift read on our show, send it to us. dlcfeedback@gmail.com is where you send those. And we appreciate them. All right. That's it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Rich Lovejoy and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for those fun bumpers. Our theme song was composed by White Cube, which is Jason Sherry and T. Ryan Arnold. Our biggest thanks are reserved for our supporters, our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. Without them, we would not be making the show. You can become one by heading over there and jumping on board. patreon.com/DLCpod. Our top tier patrons, our Hype Train patrons, they become video games. What? See, the thing is, there are some games that just don't get enough discussion. We like talking about the newest, latest, best. Christian talked about some retro stuff on this episode, but we're talking about some real retro stuff when we bring up the Peter Olberg game. Remember Olberg?
I'm a little embarrassed to admit, but when my dad showed me it, I was like, this is not going to be for me. You know, like it felt like the National National Treasure 2, you know, pick up the book, blow the dust off the cover. Yeah. My dad's like, you got to check out Peter Olberg. And I was like, Dad, I'm not interested. Holy crap.
Well, when I
incredible.
I'm a little older than you. So when I played it, it was Newberg. But now it's Oldberg. It's still a phenomenal game. So still an incredible experience.
If you're looking for it, it depends on how old you are, what you Google. Like I searched for right. Peter Oldberg. It's Oldberg, but you put the old in there to find it. And Jeff Googles Peter Current Berg, I think, for you.
Yeah, contemporary Berg.
Yeah, when I play it, it looks like Ken Burns, you know, baseball documentary.
Right.
When you play it, it looks like Planet Earth. It's That's weird.
That's just how my whole life looks. My whole life looks like a Ken Burns diet. I'm so old that my life is a documentary at this point that no one remembers. But you know, there were a lot of Berg games at the time, right? There was the Titanic iceberg game. You remember dodging the iceberg of the Titanic? There's the iceberg lettuce game. Oldberg was the grandfather of them all.
Yeah, I mean, the Titanic game was literally just the tip of the iceberg.
Tip of the Oldberg.
Of the Oldberg games.
Yeah.
You know, what you saw and what you got, vastly different. We talk about games that deliver on the promise of the premise.
Yeah.
Oldberg was like, here's the promise. And then it was like premise.
So much more premise.
So much more premise.
He's the tip of the promise.
That's what sunk the USS premise, actually. It was just the tip of the promise. That's all they saw.
I actually bought my first joystick for this game. I didn't even have joystick. I had it on PC. And by PC, I meant the computers that were available at the time. And I bought a joystick because like it was so lame trying to dodge Bergs with the arrow keys. You know,
pre WASD.
Oh yeah, nobody used WASD. It was arrow keys.
Yeah. Which was weird because also with the mouse and a shift and it just and by again by mouse I mean like hunk of brick with a wheel in it. You know, it was not a mouse by today's standard by any stretch of the imagination. It had like the moving. You got to open it up, clean it out. Yeah.
And do you remember it had for the time cutting edge technology to. To have the text to speech, the it was like Oldberg. Remember?
I didn't have a sound card, so I didn't get that. I just heard
you had to have a sound blaster in order to play it. But it was worth it because it would go Oldberg.
Mine just said Peter, and it was weird because I was like, that's all it could do. That's all my onboard sound could do. I don't know, man.
Those were good times. Those were great games. Another game we should mention, the Nick Strauss Kline game. You remember that one?
Do I ever? I thought for sure that this was going to be a fashion game. I thought like Levi Strauss, like that's just where my brain went. And
Kevin Kline.
Exactly.
Calvin Klein. I mean,
Calvin Klein. Kevin Klein is.
Kevin Klein played by Kevin Klein. Yeah.
Yeah. Very. Calvin Klein, you might not know, but that is Michael J. Fox back in time.
Right.
It's who that is. I don't know if you knew that.
But it wasn't a fashion game, was it?
No, it was not a fashion game at all, which threw me for a loop because I was super into some of those like paper craft, like build your X-Men style games that you had back then of like put this costume on Wolverine, do that or whatever. And then I opened up Nick Strauss Kline and to discover that it was, I guess, the precursor to some extent of some of these card games where it managed to replicate, you know, playing cards against somebody who I swear had a gun under the table pointed at you is what it felt like, you know, just that high intensity situation.
It redefined, you know, how you even put those card combinations together. Right. Because, you know, it like in a poker game, you'd have, you know, a flush, a straight or a straight flush. You could either have a Strauss, a Kline or a Strauss Kline. Remember?
I do. And the timer counting down the whole time, too. It felt like every time you completed a hand, you did it just in the nick of time or just in the nick of Strauss Kline.
That's right. That's right. I thought, you know, you could steal stuff. You could nick a Strauss Kline. But No, you're right.
Not with that gun under the table. Maybe you could. I never tried. I was always too afraid.
Man, so many nights I stayed up way past my bedtime trying to just – I could – it was easy to get a Strauss, and every once in a while I got a Klein. I couldn't get a Strauss Klein.
I just played it simple, and I was just – 1,000 cuts. I was just nicking them to death. That's how I played it.
Yeah.
1,000 paper cuts, you know, tiny, tiny, tiny little nicks. I would
so
find
good.
A little-
you could level up your cards. It was great. Double Strauss, double Klein, double Strauss Klein.
Yeah. Yeah. The triple nick. You don't want to forget about the triple nick.
Never forget the triple nick. Very undervalued, but it was a good strat. It was a good strat.
It was a great Strauss. Games.
Good Strauss. Good Klein. Good Strauss Klein. Hey, we appreciate all of our Hype Train patrons. Thank you for supporting us at such a high level and letting us completely butcher your names. We enjoy it. I hope you enjoy it too. Thank you. You can support the show. You can become one of the Hype Train patrons to have us do this to you. At patreon.com.
Do this to you.
Or for you, or with you, or near you. patreon.com/DLCpod. All right. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.